The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Book 1, Chapter 5, Man and Mythologies. What are here called gods might almost alternately be called the daydreams. To compare them to dreams is not to deny that dreams can come true. To compare them to travelers' tales is not to deny that they may be true tales, or at least truthful tales. In truth, they are the sort of tales the traveler tells to himself. All this mythological business belongs to the poetical part of men. It seems strangely forgotten nowadays that a myth is a work of imagination, and therefore a work of art. It needs a poet to make it. It needs a poet to criticize it. There are more poets than non-poets in the world, as is proved by the popular origin of such legends. But for some reason I have never heard explained, it is only the minority of unpoetical people who are allowed to write critical studies of these popular poems. We do not submit a sonnet to a mathematician or a song to a calculating boy, but we do indulge the equally fantastic idea that folklore can be treated as a science. Unless these things are appreciated artistically, they are not appreciated at all. When the professor is told by the Polynesian that once there was nothing except a great feathered serpent, unless the learned man feels a thrill and a half-temptation to wish it were true, he is no judge of such things at all. When he is assured, on the best Red Indian authority, that a primitive hero carried the sun and moon and stars in a box, unless he clasps his hands and almost kicks his legs, as a child would at such a charming fancy, he knows nothing about the matter. This test is not nonsensical. Primitive children and barbaric children do laugh and kick like other children, and we must have a certain simplicity to repicture the childhood of the world. When Hiawatha was told by his nurse that a warrior threw his grandmother up to the moon, he laughed like any English child told by his nurse that a cow jumped over the moon. The child sees the joke as well as most men, and better than most scientific men. But the ultimate test, even of the fantastic, is the appropriateness of the inappropriate, and the test must appear merely arbitrary because it is merely artistic. If any student tells me that the infant Hiawatha only laughed out of respect for tribal custom of sacrificing the aged to economical housekeeping, I say he did not. If any scholar tells me that the cow jumped over the moon only because a heifer was sacrificed to Diana, I answer that it did not. It happened because it is obviously the right thing for a cow to jump over the moon. Mythology is a lost art, one of the few arts that really are lost, but it is an art. The horned moon and the horned moon calf make a harmonious and almost a quiet pattern. And throwing your grandmother into the sky is not good behavior, but it is perfectly good taste. Thus scientists seldom understand, as artists understand, that one branch of the beautiful is the ugly. They seldom allow for the legitimate liberty of the grotesque. And they will dismiss a savage myth as merely coarse and clumsy and an evidence of degradation, because it has not all the beauty of the Herald Mercury new lighted on a heaven-kissing hill, when it really has the beauty of the Mock Turtle or the Mad Hatter. It is the supreme proof of a man being prosaic that he always insists on poetry being poetical. Sometimes the humor is in the very subject as well as the style of the fable. The Australian Aborigines, regarded as the rudest of savages, have a story about a giant frog who had swallowed the sea and all the waters of the world, and who was only forced to spill them by being made to laugh. all the animals with all their antics passed before him, and like Queen Victoria, he was not amused. He collapsed at last before an eel who stood delicately balanced on the tip of its tail, doubtless with a rather desperate dignity. Any amount of fine fantastic literature might be made out of that fable. There is philosophy in that vision of the dry world before the beatific deluge of laughter. There is imagination in the mountainous monster erupting like an aqueous volcano. There is plenty of fun in the thought of his goggling visage as the pelican or the penguin passed by. Anyhow, the frog laughed, but the folklore student remains grave. Moreover, even when the fables are inferior as art, they cannot be properly judged by science, still less properly judged as science. Some myths are very crude and queer, like the early drawings of children, but the child is trying to draw. It is none the less an error to treat his drawing as if it were a diagram, or intended to be a diagram. The student cannot make a scientific statement about the savage, because the savage is not making a scientific statement about the world. He is saying something quite different, what might be called the gossip of the gods. We may say, if we like, that it is believed before there is time to examine it. It would be truer to say that it is accepted before there is time to believe it. I confess I doubt the whole theory of the dissemination of myths, or, as it commonly is, of one myth. It is true that something in our nature and conditions makes many stories similar, but each of them may be original. One man does not borrow the story from the other man, though he may tell it from the same motive as the other man. It would be easy to apply the whole argument about legend to literature, and turn it into a vulgar monomania of plagiarism. I would undertake to trace a notion like that of the Golden Bough through individual modern novels, as easily as through communal and antiquated myths. I would undertake to find something like a bunch of flowers figuring again and again, from the fatal bouquet of Becky Sharp to the spray of roses sent by the Princess of Ruritania. But although these flowers may spring from the same soil, it is not the same faded flower that is flung from hand to hand. These flowers are always fresh. The true origin of all the myths has been discovered much too often. There are too many keys to mythology, as there are too many cryptograms in Shakespeare. Everything is phallic. Everything is totemistic. Everything is seed time and harvest. Everything is ghosts and grave offerings. Everything is the golden bough of sacrifice. Everything is the sun and moon. Everything is everything. Every folklore student who knew a little more than his own monomania, every man of wider reading and critical culture like Andrew Lang, has practically confessed that the bewilderment of these things left his brain spinning. Yet the whole trouble comes from a man trying to look at these stories from the outside, as if they were scientific objects. He has only to look at them from the inside, and ask himself how he would begin a story. A story may start with anything and go anywhere. It may start with a bird without the bird being a totem. It may start with the sun without being a solar myth. It is said that there are only 10 plots in the world, and there will certainly be common and recurrent elements. Set 10,000 children talking at once and telling taradiddles about what they did in the wood, and it will not be hard to find parallels suggesting sun worship or animal worship. Some of the stories may be pretty, and some silly, and some perhaps dirty, but they can only be judged as stories. In the modern dialect, they can only be judged aesthetically. it is strange that aesthetics, or mere feeling, which is now allowed to usurp where it has no rights at all, to wreck reason with pragmatism and morals with anarchy, is apparently not allowed to give a purely aesthetic judgment on what is obviously a purely aesthetic question. We may be fanciful about everything except fairy tales. Now, the first fact is that the most simple people have the most subtle ideas. Everybody ought to know that, for everybody has been a child. Ignorant as a child is, he knows more than he can say, and feels not only atmospheres, but fine shades. And in this matter, there are several fine shades. Nobody understands it who has not had what can only be called the ache of the artist, to find some sense and some story in the beautiful things he sees. His hunger for secrets, and his anger at any tower or tree escaping with its tale untold. He feels that nothing is perfect unless it is personal. Without that, the blind, unconscious beauty of the world stands in its garden like a headless statue. One need only be a very minor poet to have wrestled with the tower or the tree until it spoke like a titan or a dryad. It is often said that pagan mythology was a personification of the powers of nature. The phrase is true in a sense, but it is very unsatisfactory, because it implies that the forces are abstractions and the personification is artificial. Myths are not allegories. Natural powers are not, in this case, abstractions. It is not as if there were a god of gravitation. There may be a genius of the waterfall, but not of mere falling, even less than of mere water. The impersonation is not of something impersonal. The point is that the personality perfects the water with significance. Father Christmas is not an allegory of snow and holly. He is not merely the stuff called snow, afterwards artificially given a human form, like a snowman. He is something that gives a new meaning to the white world and the evergreens, so that snow itself seems to be warm rather than cold. The test, therefore, is purely imaginative. But imaginative does not mean imaginary. It does not follow that it is all what the moderns call subjective, when they mean false. Every true artist does feel, consciously or unconsciously, that he is touching transcendental truths, that his images are shadows of things seen through the veil. In other words, the natural mystic does know that there is something there, something behind the clouds or within the trees, but he believes that the pursuit of beauty is the way to find it, that imagination is a sort of incantation that can call it up. Now, we do not comprehend this process in ourselves, far less in our most remote fellow creatures. And the danger of these things being classified is that they may seem to be comprehended. A really fine work of folklore like The Golden Bough will leave too many readers with the idea, for instance, that this or that story of a giant's or a wizard's heart in a casket or a cave only means some stupid and static superstition called the external soul. But we do not know what these things mean, simply because we do not know what we ourselves mean when we are moved by them. Suppose somebody in a story says, "Pluck the door, and a princess will die in a castle beyond the sea." We do not know why something stirs in the subconsciousness, or why what is impossible seems almost inevitable. Suppose we read, "And in the hour when the king extinguished the candle, his ships were wrecked far away on the coast of the Hebrides." We do not know why the imagination has accepted that image before the reason can reject it, or why such correspondences seem really to correspond to something in the soul. Very deep things in our nature, some dim sense of the dependence of great things upon small, some dark suggestion that the things nearest to us stretch far beyond our power, some sacramental feeling of the magic in material substances, and many more emotions past fading out, are in an idea like that of the external soul. The power, even in the myths of savages, is like the power in the metaphors of poets. The soul of such a metaphor is often, very emphatically, an external soul. The best critics have remarked that in the best poets, the simile is often a picture that seems quite separate from the text. It is as irrelevant as the remote castle to the flower, or the Hebridean coast to the candle. Shelley compares the skylark to a young woman on a turret, to a rose embedded in thick foliage, to a series of things that seem to be about as unlike a skylark in the sky as anything we can imagine. I suppose that the most potent piece of pure magic in English literature is the much-quoted passage in Keats' Nightingale about the casements opening on the perilous foam. And nobody notices that the image seems to come from nowhere, that it appears abruptly after some almost equally irrelevant remarks about Ruth, and that it has nothing in the world to do with the subject of the poem. If there is one place in the world where nobody could reasonably expect to find a nightingale, it is on a windowsill at the seaside. But it is only in the same sense that nobody would expect to find a giant's heart in a casket under the sea. Now, it would be very dangerous to classify the metaphors of the poets. When Shelley says that the cloud will rise like a child from the womb, like a ghost from the tomb, it would be quite possible to call the first a case of the coarse primitive birth myth, and the second a survival of the ghost worship which became ancestor worship. But it is the wrong way of dealing with a cloud, and is liable to leave the learned in the condition of Polonius, only too ready to think it like a weasel, or very like a whale. Two facts follow from this psychology of daydreams, which must be kept in mind throughout their development in mythologies and even religions. First, these imaginative impressions are often strictly local. So far from being abstractions turned into allegories, they are often images almost concentrated into idols. The poet feels the mystery of a particular forest, not of the science of afforestation or the department of woods and forests. He worships the peak of a particular mountain, not the abstract idea of altitude. So we find the god is not merely water, but often one special river. He may be the sea, because the sea is single like a stream, the river that runs round the world. Ultimately, doubtless many deities are enlarged into elements, but they are something more than omnipresent. Apollo does not merely dwell wherever the sun shines. His home is on the rock of Delphi. Diana is great enough to be in three places at once, earth and heaven and hell. But greater is Diana of the Ephesians. This localized feeling has its lowest form in the mere fetish or talisman, such as millionaires put on their motor cars. But it can also harden into something like a high and serious religion, where it is connected with high and serious duties. Into the gods of the city, or even the gods of the hearth. The second consequence is this, that in these pagan cults, There is every shade of sincerity and insincerity. In what sense exactly did an Athenian really think he had to sacrifice to Pallas Athena? What scholar is really certain of the answer? In what sense did Dr. Johnson really think that he had to touch all the posts in the street, or that he had to collect orange peel? In what sense does a child really think that he ought to step on every alternate paving stone? Two things are at least fairly clear. First, in simpler and less self-conscious times, these forms could become more solid without really becoming more serious. Daydreams could be acted in broad daylight, with more liberty of artistic expression, but still perhaps with something of the light step of the somnambulist. Wrap Dr. Johnson in an antique mantle, crown him, by his kind permission, with a garland, and he will move in state under those ancient skies of morning, touching a series of sacred posts carved with the heads of the strange terminal gods that stand at the limits of the land and of the life of man. Make the child free of the marbles and mosaics of some classic temples to play on a whole floor inlaid with squares of black and white, and he will willingly make this fulfillment of his idle and drifting daydream the clear field for a grave and graceful dance. But the posts and the paving stones are little more and little less real than they are under modern limits. They are not really much more serious for being taken seriously. They have the sort of sincerity that they have always had, the sincerity of art as a symbol that expresses very real spiritualities under the surface of life. But they are only sincere in the same sense as art. Not sincere in the same sense as morality. The eccentric's collection of orange peel may turn to oranges in a Mediterranean festival, or to golden apples in a Mediterranean myth. But they are never on the same plane with the difference between giving the orange to a blind beggar and carefully placing the orange peel so that the beggar may fall and break his leg. Between these two things there is a difference of kind, and not of degree. The child does not think it wrong to step on the paving stone as he thinks it wrong to step on the dog's tail. And it is very certain that whatever jest or sentiment or fancy first set Johnson touching the wooden posts, he never touched wood with any of the feeling with which he stretched out his hands to the timber of that terrible tree which was the death of God and the life of man. As already noted, this does not mean that there was no reality, or even no religious sentiment, in such a mood. As a matter of fact, the Catholic Church has taken over with uproarious success the whole of this popular business of giving people local legends and lighter ceremonial movements. In so far as all this sort of paganism was innocent and in touch with nature, there is no reason why it should not be patronized by patron saints as much as by pagan gods. And in any case, there are degrees of seriousness in the most natural make-believe. There is all the difference between fancying there are fairies in the wood, which often only means fancying a certain wood as fit for fairies, and really frightening ourselves until we walk a mile rather than pass a house we have told ourselves is haunted. Behind all these things is the fact that beauty and terror are very real things and related to a real spiritual world. And to touch them at all, even in doubt or fancy, is to stir the deep things of the soul. We all understand that, and the pagans understood it. The point is that paganism did not really stir the soul except with these doubts and fancies, with the consequence that we today can have little beyond doubts and fancies about paganism. All the best critics agree that all the greatest poets, in pagan Hellas, for example, had an attitude towards their gods which is quite queer and puzzling to men in the Christian era. There seems to be an admitted conflict between the God and the man, but everybody seems to be doubtful about which is the hero and which is the villain. This doubt does not merely apply to a doubter like Euripides in the Bacchae. It applies to a moderate conservative like Sophocles in the Antigone, or even to a regular Tory and reactionary like Aristophanes in the Frogs. Sometimes it would seem that the Greeks believed above all things in reverence, only they had nobody to revere. But the point of the puzzle is this, that all this vagueness and variation arise from the fact that the whole thing began in fancy and in dreaming, and that there are no rules of architecture for a castle in the clouds. End of part 1 of chapter 5.